It is a universal truth to say that everybody likes a happy ending. I have not yet a person who's watched a movie with a happy ending and been disappointed. I think instinctively when we read a book, we watch a movie, we watch a television show, our natural instinct is to want a positive outcome. And so when you read the book of Nehemiah, as you watch the flow of it, it begins with great problems, but you see those problems begin to untangle, you see progress, and you begin to wonder and imagine, this is going to end well, isn't it? Well, not exactly. The book actually ends with some very serious conflict that needs to be resolved. Now, there have been many highlights along the way. Many positive steps have been taken. Through great adversity and opposition, the walls of Jerusalem, which were in ruins, were completely rebuilt and restored in the span of 52 days. And we read about this in chapter 6. We read about how after the completion of the wall that the people of Jerusalem engaged in vibrant worship in chapter 8. In chapter 10, the people rededicate themselves to the Lord. They don't simply show up for a party, for worship services, but they make promises to one another and to the Lord about how they will conduct themselves in society. In chapter 12, we read about a huge celebration as the wall is finally dedicated with an official ceremony. We're told that the joy of Jerusalem at that service was palpable, that the joy of Jerusalem was noticed by the neighboring communities and nations. As Nehemiah records in chapter 12, the joy of Jerusalem was heard from afar. Well done, Nehemiah. Your vision has been realized. The people of Jerusalem are satisfied. God is glorified. Nehemiah, put your pen down. Roll up the scroll. Thank you for a good story. But not so fast. The final chapter of this book reveals that the people ultimately return to their former ways. Their former sins are repeated, and the ordinances of God are once again neglected. On one level, I lament the way this book comes to a close, but on another level, I really appreciate that this story doesn't end all that positively. I appreciate the conclusion of Nehemiah's book because it's down to earth. It's not candy-coated. It's not whitewashed. It's not censored. It is more in sync with real life experience. Good times are not perpetual, are they? Seasons of prosperity and ease are often interrupted by seasons of hardship. And so we see the people of Jerusalem begin to revert to their former ways. Well, the downturn has many prongs that we could look at, but for our purposes this morning, I want us to focus on Nehemiah 13, verses 4 through 14, if you're following along in your scriptures. In verse 4, you might recognize that an old nemesis resurfaces. Tobiah, who was the critic of Nehemiah and a vehement opponent of reconstruction, has taken up residence in the temple of all places. So you've got the holy city of Jerusalem being rebuilt, and the walls are important, and the gates are important, and then you have the temple, God's dwelling place. And the opponent of Jerusalem, Tobiah, takes up residence. He has an alliance with Eliashib the priest, and this alliance allows him to have some cozy quarters to live in. You might remember that earlier in the book, Tobiah is said to have personally mocked Nehemiah, causing Nehemiah to say to him, "You have no portion, no right, no memorial in Jerusalem." And so here lies our predicament. The man who is to have no portion in the revival of Jerusalem now has a cozy suite within the temple. The man who once remarked that even a fox could knock down their inadequately repaired walls was now enjoying a life of security within those same walls. How did this come to pass? How did one of Nehemiah's fiercest opponents gain such privileged access to the temple? There is more to the answer than simply identifying the alliance that he had made with Eliashib. We should also note that a significant amount of time has passed since the walls were completed. That is to say that if you're not looking carefully at the timelines in Nehemiah, you might miss that there's a massive time lag between the events of the first 12 chapters and the final chapter, chapter 13. Or let me put it this way, if we're watching the television show Lost, we would say that chapter 13 is a fast forward. It's a leap 12 years into the future. And so circumstances have radically changed. Previously, under Nehemiah's leadership, things had been restored. Faith in God had been revived. But now Nehemiah had departed. He'd moved on, moved back to Persia. And a reversal has taken place. What we saw in building up the walls was selfless sacrifice by the people of God. But now this has been replaced by an every man for himself kind of attitude. The context was favoritism and corruption, and these traits were carrying the day. Now, I don't know if you've been with us all along through this entire series. I'm curious to know what you think about Nehemiah. I happen to think he's a great leader. I happen to notice he's a very bold leader, and in many ways, he's far bolder than I'll ever be. And if you want evidence of that, let me read you and show you verses 8 and 9, because this is the epitome of boldness. Nehemiah responding to Tobiah in the temple. It upset me so much that I threw out every bit of furniture. Then I ordered the room to be cleaned, and the temple utensils, and the grain offerings, and the incense to be brought back into the room. Can you imagine what a leadership style we have here? Can you imagine the scene of what's being described here? Can you imagine Tobiah's response when he returns home that day? Why is all my stuff here on the curb? This is a mess. Why? What are these vats of grain doing in my bedroom? Why does this place smell like incense? I mean, it's a very bold and aggressive move for Nehemiah to say, let's get all his stuff out and let's put everything back to the way it was. Was Nehemiah being unduly harsh? I don't think he was. I'm not saying I would have been able to be as bold, but I don't think this was too harsh. Because for Nehemiah, God's honor was at stake here. God's honor was at stake here. As I think about defending God's honor, one of my favorite quotes comes from the French reformer John Calvin, who wrote, "A dog barks when his master is attacked. And I would be a coward if I saw God's honor attacked and remained silent." God's honor was at stake here, and Nehemiah defended it. You read on and you see God's honor was also at stake in the issue of tithing. And for those who haven't heard of the word tithing, tithing is the practice of giving a tenth of something. So if you had a certain amount of oil, you gave a tenth of it. You had a certain amount of barley, you gave a tenth of it. A certain amount of money, a certain amount of wine, you gave a tenth. And what we're told is that the people over time had begun to neglect this practice of giving up a tenth. And we read that this had some very measurable effects on the community. With insufficient funds being collected, that meant there wasn't enough money to pay the musicians, not enough money to pay the priests. Moreover, since the priests not only depended on the funds, but they depended on the harvest, the wine, the oil, the grain. Because a tenth of that wasn't coming in, a lot of the priests had to go back to their own farms. And just as a side note, if anyone was wondering, even though I come from a farming family, I don't have the foggiest idea how to farm. So, and not to tell you how much to put in the collection plate, but I need you to know that farming is not an option for me. The people in Nehemiah's day weren't giving their fair share. and it cost people jobs. Perhaps the people of Nehemiah's day were saying things like, well, things aren't the way they used to be. Everyone is noticing there's an economic downturn taking place. And so we need to operate differently in these economic conditions. We need to look after ourselves first. We need to look after our families first. And after we've done this, we'll find out what's left over and we'll give that for God's purposes. Or perhaps the alliance between Tobiah and Eliashib caused the problem of the neglected tithe. Maybe the people were saying, I'm tired of this institutionalized religion. It's just a bunch of cronies helping one another. It's a bunch of unholy alliances, and I'm not financing any of this crooked organization. Maybe that was some of the reason behind the tithe being neglected. Now, some leaders would have walked into this situation and just shrugged their shoulders and said, this problem's too big for any one person to fix. But that was not Nehemiah's instinct. Nehemiah was determined to do what was right in the eyes of God. And to this end, he approaches the leaders and speaks to them directly and asks them in verse 11, why is the temple neglected? And this is great. Then I told them to start doing their jobs. Now, I don't know about how you lead in your various workplaces and environments, but I have found that telling people what to do, ordering people around, isn't always the best practice. Usually you reason with people, you inspire people, you build them up. And I've found that the more you build people up, the more motivated they are to work. But Nehemiah apparently has been reading very different books than I have, because Nehemiah simply says, I told them to start doing their jobs. And I wouldn't encourage you to go into your workplace tomorrow and start pointing fingers and say, start doing your work. It's not going to be effective. But amazingly, you read at verse 12, everyone must have known Nehemiah was right. Everyone must have known deep down that they had been neglecting something very important, because it says after this, after Nehemiah told them to smarten up, it says everyone in Judah brought a tenth of their grain, wine, and olive oil to the temple storeroom. Wouldn't it be great if life worked like that for all of us? We just told someone what they needed to do and it got done. Miraculously, this happens for Nehemiah. Now, I realize I've just given you a whole lot of background. I've tried to work through 13 chapters of a biblical book in a very short period of time. But I've given you a sermon title that I've not even touched on. And so I want to move now from the story of Nehemiah to the application of what we learn from Nehemiah. And I realize that we've been studying this book for 10 weeks, and we've been gleaning many principles that I hope will be effective and helpful as you lead others in your context. But this morning, I want to leave you with one principle in particular. I want you to never tire of doing the right thing. I want you to never tire of doing the right thing. Don't let up when it comes to matters of integrity. Keep moving forward and don't ever hit the pause button. Always keep the honor of God in view. Because when we talk about doing the right thing, when we talk about being people of integrity, we're saying that in comparison to a standard. We know the right thing if we have the right standard. We know what's the move of integrity if we know where truth is. And so we must always keep the honor of God in view, because that will direct our actions. Now, I say that, and that's not an easy thing. And I don't mean to sound unkind when I say that most of us have a devotion to God that could be marked or said to be seasonal. And the reason I know that many people have seasonal devotion to God is because I sometimes find that I have seasonal devotion to God. There are times where I find that I am passionate and highly motivated to work for God and to see His kingdom advanced. But I must tell you, that's not 24 hours a day. That's not 7 days a week. That's not necessarily 12 months in every year. I know what it's like to have dips and downturns in your relationship with Christ. Now, I think very few of us would say that we're altogether negligent with the things of God. I think all of us, if we did a spiritual inventory this morning, would see some things to be happy about. But many of us, if we're honest, many of us will admit that our devotion to God is sporadic. Our devotion to God is qualified. Our devotion to God can sometimes be lacking. Well, the threats to our relationship with Jesus are many. But this morning, as I read the book of Nehemiah, the threat that stands out is the threat of complacency. The threat is complacency, that those who think they are the most righteous are in the greatest danger. Those who imagine they have the most spiritual health are the most vulnerable. We're reminded by the text this morning that there is a temptation to rest on our laurels, to think about all the Bible study classes we went to as a kid, all the religious studies courses we took in high school and university, all the years that we've been a part of a Christian home. There's a temptation to coast on the momentum of our previous accomplishments. Well, in my experience, Christian congregations that become complacent are destined to diminish in size and in influence. And in my experience, when the complacency within a church is left unchecked, the very existence of that local congregation is jeopardized. I think most of you know that before I came here, I pastored for 8 years in the city of Toronto, Canada. And when I began in that presbytery, we had 24 congregations. And in 8 years, we closed 4 of them. And to be honest, if we were as aggressive as we probably should have been, we should have closed 8 congregations. We were leaving open congregations that had 15, 20, 25 people on a Sunday. We were leaving open congregations that had 0 children. And you need to remember, this is Toronto. This is a city with 3.5 million people, where every neighborhood is packed. And having a congregation of 25 people in that context makes very little sense. But what is striking as I share this experience with you is that almost all of the congregations we closed knew what it was like to be full. The congregations that we closed knew what it was like to see what you see today. And I think this is such an important message for the Kirk people to hear. If you've been here over the last few Sundays, I've been pretty excited about how full it is. It's my first Sunday in a long time I've had to look to my right while I preach. It is a great delight, by the way. I don't want you to think that I regret this at all. We've been full for over a month now. I'm very, very excited. But I'm cautiously excited because of the threat of complacency. Some of you know the story of my very first visit to this congregation. Just about 2 years ago, I was nothing more than a pastoral candidate, nothing more than a 30-something-year-old tucked away in the corner hoping no one will notice. But it was difficult to not be noticed because there was only 35 people in the Kirk that day. There was only 3 children in the Kirk that day. And I'm grateful for that experience because it's a powerful reminder to me how quickly things can come apart. How quickly we can go from a full church to an empty church. And the greatest threat to the local congregation might be our own complacency. To imagine that we've arrived. Oh, look at us. We're full. I noticed the church down the street wasn't full. We must be doing better. No. We must always be guarded against coasting on our previous accomplishments. Now, complacency, if I'm to talk about the word, it's difficult. Complacency is easier to identify than it is to define. If I say to you, give me an example of complacency, point it out, that'll be easy. But defining it is a little more difficult. So where do we see complacency? I bet many of you see complacency in the workplace. You see people who are punching in and punching out and not doing a whole lot in between. Some of you know complacency in the workplace. Some of you see complacency in the schools. You see students who are doing just enough to get by. They cut the odd class. They don't work as hard on assignments. They know what it takes to get a B or an A minus. They don't put in maximum effort, and so they coast. We see complacency in significant relationships. We see that we can sometimes take for granted the people who are closest to us. Our spouse, our children, our parents. We see complacency even in athletics. They say that the most complacent athlete is the one who's just signed the $1 million long-term contract. Because once you've got the big contract for many years, there's a real temptation to take it easy and to not to do the little things that got you there. There's complacency, I'm sure, in the field of music, in arts, in almost any realm where effort is required, we will find complacency. So how do I want to describe this? This is not a definition, but here's the best way I can think of to describe complacency. Complacency is born from the myth that says, I can succeed without maximum effort. Complacency is born from the myth that says, I can succeed without giving maximum effort. And so going back to Nehemiah, there was a complacency related to the people's commitment to God. The people of Nehemiah's generation wanted all the benefits of being God's favored people. But they didn't want all the corresponding commitment that went with that favor. So once the walls were complete, they imagined that less than maximum effort would suffice. And that's the great temptation for so many today. When we are 20-something or 30-something years of age, and we're in a serious dating relationship, I've observed how partners are so attentive to one another. So attentive in the gift buying and the flowers and the chocolates and the date nights. And when you're courting someone, when you're seriously dating, there is so much effort that's joyfully invested. And yet we notice in marriages, many marriages, complacency sets in there. And the date nights become few and far between. The flowers are nowhere to be seen. The chocolates never make their way home. I worry that you laugh because you know to some degree I'm describing my own lack of effort in bringing flowers home. Think about, and even our students here today can probably identify with this, think about the first time or the most recent time that you had to prepare a resume to get a job, or the first time or the most recent time that you prepared yourself for a job interview. And you get the job, and you worked really hard leading up to this, and you get the job, and your first day on the job is like you're shot out of a cannon. And business owners will know exactly what I'm talking about. The best employee is almost always the new employee, because they move around a million miles per hour. But eventually they begin to notice their colleagues aren't moving at quite the same speed. They realize that there's an average speed that their coworkers are moving at which they can still keep their job. And so again, this becomes the tendency for many of us. Or maybe you're the student. Maybe you're thinking about a particular college admission or a particular scholarship that you'd like, and you're working very, very hard to reach this goal. And so my question for you this morning, will you keep that same effort once you reach your destination? Because so often we say, if I only get here, if I only get that, if I only reach this and win that, then I'll be fine. But what are you going to do when you get there? When you get there, complacency will be waiting for you. And the example of Nehemiah gives us an alternative. Give maximum effort all of the time. Never, ever give up. Now, I know you can apply that principle in a variety of different contexts. With your schoolwork, in the workplace, in your home. There's so many ways you can apply the universal principle of 100% effort and not letting up ever. But I wouldn't want any of you to miss applying this principle where I would like to suggest it matters the most. Our pursuit of Christ-likeness requires maximum effort and a steady persistence that never gives in to complacency. Now, as I say this, I don't know where many of you are at. As I look out here, I don't know the current condition of your relationship with Jesus Christ. I don't know if pursuing Christ is a new thing for you, an old thing for you, a seasonal thing for you, or a not yet thing for you. But I want to encourage you with this. Where you've been matters a lot less than where you're going. Where you've been, what's happened to you, your success or lack thereof so far, where you've been matters less than where you're headed today. So the call of Nehemiah, the example of Nehemiah, is to get back on track and to have forward momentum. And I'm inviting you to direct that forward momentum not simply at a career, not simply at a grade, but forward momentum towards Jesus Christ. Because whatever you need, whatever you really need, whatever you lack, is in Him. And when you find what you're looking for, when you find Him, when you find yourself restored, when you find yourself renewed, be on guard against the threat of complacency. The story can end well for each of us. And Nehemiah has shown us the way. Never tire of doing the right thing. Never tire of pursuing Jesus Christ. Amen.